I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from a West Asia transformed by war on Gaza. NATO nation so-called mainstream media might make you think violence in Palestine began 23 days ago on October the 7th, but alleged genocide is repeated since the 1947 UN General Assembly vote to create a Jewish sector in Palestine. Fake news used by the powerful to go to war in the Middle East is a specialty of British historian Sir Lawrence Freedman. He was on the UK Public Inquiry exposing secrets that led to the NATO nation war on Iraq. Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, author of Command, The Politics of Military Operations from Korea to Ukraine, joins me from the British capital. Thank you so much, Sir Lawrence, for coming on. I didn't mention there that, of course, the future Middle East envoy, Tony Blair, you wrote or helped write his infamous 1999 speech in Chicago on the doctrine of international community. I mean, I've got to ask you first your take on what UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls clear violations of international law by an Israel, of course, supported by Britain, the United States, European Union nations. I should say Britain did abstain with Russia on one resolution on Gaza.
Well, the UN Secretary General actually condemned both sides for violations of international law, not just Israel. And he did so because Hamas places weapons, rockets that it's firing into Israel in the middle of civilian areas, which is a war crime. So no side comes out particularly well.
Well, Israel immediately said that he has to resign. The Israeli ambassador said.
Yeah, well, he's not going to resign. Israel. I'm not a spokesman for the Israeli.
I just wonder what your view was of the fact the UN Security Council's secretary, you know, the UN Secretary General has said this. And I should add, Israel said immediately he should resign, which I've never heard of.
He's not going to resign. He has got a job to do balancing lots of different views and perspectives.
Of course.
I think Israel is very sensitive to the fact that it feels it was the aggrieved case in here, whenever there is a sort of a equidistance between the aggressor and the aggrieved, you'll get this sort of response, obviously.
Can you remember a time? I mean, you've been observing this for decades, where a country has not only said a UN Secretary General has to resign, but that they will no longer allow any UN personnel visas to enter a country after a speech.
There have actually been instances where people have got pretty cross with the UN Secretary General. Guterres is actually quite an outspoken Secretary General. Many of them keep a much lower profile. He's been more outspoken on Russia, Ukraine than other Secretary Generals might have been, and Russia hasn't particularly liked that. So he's out in front. I think the Israeli reaction is overdone, and I suspect they'll resolve from it eventually.
I mean, I suppose what I'm getting at is it took you 7 years for you and your fellow Privy Councillors to report that Britain and the United States had undermined the authority of the UN Security Council in what you judged as the unnecessary Iraq war that killed, wounded or displaced tens of millions in the region. I mean, clear just after a few weeks, they're doing the same thing all over again. Britain, in fairness, did abstain with Russia at one resolution, as I said, but the United States repeatedly rejecting, say, the Brazilian resolution for a ceasefire, not wanting a ceasefire, while all around the world we see the pictures of thousands of children being killed.
Well, you could ask why there weren't ceasefires between Syria. You can ask why there weren't ceasefires in Yemen. When these wars are underway, one side favours a ceasefire and another one doesn't.
I didn't realise. So you're saying the United States is a belligerent?
Personally, this is not an unusual situation. It's why you're not getting a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. As far as Israel is concerned, and again, I'm not speaking for Israel, but you might as well know their view. As far as Israel is concerned, if Hamas launched an attack on Israel, which brutally killed large numbers of civilians, and while Hamas is in charge of Gaza, they fear it'll happen again. So they're trying to remove them. If they have a ceasefire, that won't happen. Personally, I don't think what they're doing is going to see Hamas removed, and they're going to have to look for other methods of achieving that objective. But that's why they're not accepting a ceasefire. The issue with this problem is whether we can find a way to produce an outcome that is good for the Palestinians, not particularly good for Hamas necessarily, but good for the Palestinians, and produces stability where there has been constant instability for many decades.
But so you still think that, despite what the Secretary General said about, infamously, that those attacks that you're referring to did not occur in a vacuum, something I'm sure most people would agree with, you wouldn't say that Israel, as set up by Britain, is it a tenable state as it has been acting in the region for so many years? I mean, I know there was normalization talks, ideas.
Well, most states in the region now accept the existence of the state of Israel. It's tenable. 9 million people live
there. Hamas kind of does, because it wants the 1967 borders.
The difficulty, let's go back to the Secretary General's statement. The difficulty, it seems to me obvious that all conflicts have a history, they therefore have a context, and this one emerges out of that context. Oddly, in this case, it emerges out of a belief amongst the Netanyahu government that they should push harder in the West Bank, in the belief that actually they had some sort of understanding with Hamas, which is why they were taken so much by surprise. So there's a question of the immediate trigger, but the history of this part of the world, which goes back well before the Balfour Declaration, is one of constant tension and conflict between. And of course, the Jews settled in Israel long before 1947-8. It goes back a long time. So they're not going away. This is their home. The question is, under what conditions does Israel continue to exist, and as it has done up to now, thrive as an economy and society without at the same time making life miserable and depressing for the Palestinian population?
Yeah, no, I mean, clearly no one is saying anyone should go home. As I said, Hamas recognized 1967.
Well, Hamas has said very different things during its existence.
Okay,
its stance is rejectionist. At one point, it did talk about the 1967 boundaries, but its basic stance is rejectionist, which suited Netanyahu. This is what's so sad and tragic about this sort of thing, where you have the hardliners on both sides feeding off each other.
Yeah, of course, you've suggested a medium-term solution of boosting the Palestinian Authority. I know you did recognise the problems with that. Maybe explain the problems you recognise in that, because don't they just have equally poor democratic legitimacy? Hamas was elected, PA was elected, but the elections were years ago.
Yeah, I think there's problems with democratic legitimacy for reasons we understand. The Palestinian Authority does not have a good reputation. It's Abbas is getting quite old now. It's been corrupt. It hasn't been particularly effective, and it's been consistently undermined by the Israeli government. So it hasn't had a great time. I think most people looking at solutions now, which is where I think it's most useful to look, are talking about the Palestinian Authority plus. You need the other Arab states in the region closely involved, I think, in trying to work out what you do about developing a legitimate and effective governance in Gaza. Because in the West Bank, it's a territorial issue about who holds what territory. That's not the issue with the Gaza Strip. It's about the conditions in which it can trade and people can move in and out and so on, which clearly is not possible at this moment. So I think the if you're looking for the future, you're going to be looking for the Palestinian Authority, but with a much bigger, wider Arab and international engagement, just simply because of the resources that are going to be necessary to put the Gaza Strip back on its feet.
And is that without the United States? Because obviously nothing we're watching of the horrors inflicted on Gaza could be happening without the arming of Israel by the United States, by Britain and European Union nations. One Israeli general being quoted in Israeli press saying, you know, whatever we do, we take our orders de facto now as to what's happening from Washington.
Well, actually, if you look at what he was saying when he said that, what he was saying, we're taking
just our remind orders us what he said.
Because, the Americans have asked us to make sure that we work to get the humanitarian relief into Gaza. That's what he was saying. So the Americans have an enormous influence on Israel, but anybody who's watched the history of US-Israel relations and US attempts to engage in the region knows the ability of the United States to get any Israeli government to do exactly what it wants is pretty limited.
Because some say there's growing feeling within Israel, obviously there's a huge opposition before October 7th to Netanyahu, who feel actually what the United States has done over all these decades is used Israel as a proxy there in the Middle East and not allowed Israel to be created as a normal state in the region, making alliances and links to regional Arab powers. It's being used.
Well, it is a normal state in the region now. In that sense, it has been making links with a large number of Arab countries and was about to do so with Saudi Arabia. I don't think, states aren't used as proxies in this way. They all have agency. Everybody's got agency in all of this. Nobody's acting just at somebody else's behest. Israel went through a period in the early 90s, it went through a period even in the 60s, when it was possible to imagine a different sort of Israel to the one that developed, with different sort of borders. They had the Oslo process as well. Those of us who remember what happened to the Oslo process was, as it was going on, Hamas was regularly mounting bomb attacks and so on within Israel to derail the process.
Which we spoke to the former Israeli foreign minister and on the previous Going Underground, who said the Oslo Accords were a failure, and he then became chief negotiator, Professor Shlomo Ben-Ami. But without getting too into the information about all those different failed peace processes, let's just get to WMD. I mean, in the Iraq inquiry, you slammed MI6, blaming it for Iraq WMD claims. Israel has WMD, and I'm not the alleged chemical weapons, of course, that are being used. White phosphorus is there, but of course, nuclear weapons. How does the current slaughter in the context of Israel having nuclear weapons change things? There was, in the initial aftermath of October 7, there was talk about Hamas capturing or getting to Dimona.
I'd be very surprised if it got to Dimona. Israel has been an undeclared nuclear power for a number of decades now. It has been an important factor as a reminder of why a war in that region that went to war between states, Iran and Israel, for example, would be potentially very catastrophic. It was raised as a potential issue during the 1973 war. I haven't actually seen it raised as something that could be used or has any particular relevance to this case.
Sir Lawrence Friedman, I'll stop you there. More from the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, known as the Dean of British Strategic Studies, after this break.
Netanyahu wants to dissolve the current conflict in a bigger conflict, which he is now trying to deliberately create. The bigger conflict, I think, is a conflict with Iran. Netanyahu is trying to shift the narrative, completely shift the narrative, claiming that what is going on has nothing to do with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict per se. The real reason for the crisis is Iran.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, the Iraq Inquiry's Sir Lawrence Friedman. Sir Lawrence, we were just talking about why many people don't really talk about Israel's nuclear weapons program. Obviously, they deny they have one. It's not subject to the NPT. Why do you think it is that no one talks about it? Because surely that would change.
They never wholly deny they have one. The official line is, we won't be the first to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East, but we won't be the second. It's words. It's not a declared nuclear power. It's never had a nuclear test. There are some questions about an event in South Africa in the late 70s, but there's never been a declared nuclear test. It's not a declared nuclear power. It's happy for people to assume it's a nuclear power because it gets a deterrent benefit from that, but it doesn't have the consequences of actually declaring it. And it's lived like that for many decades now.
Yeah, the library in the House of Commons in London, upon which our legislators in Britain rely on for information to legislate, clearly says it's near universally accepted they have nuclear weapons. Yeah. But isn't it important then that if indeed resistance fighters did capture Dimona in any way, that would make it very relevant indeed.
If somebody got to Dimona, they get to a nuclear reactor and somewhere that produces fissionable material, they wouldn't get to the weapons. I find it very hard to believe that they would get that far. They might strike it. I mean, the Iraqis tried to strike it with Scuds during the 1991 Desert Storm, but that's a different issue. I don't think it's one of the main scenarios to worry about at the moment.
It's clear that China and Russia don't agree with Britain, France, and the United States at the UN Security Council. I mean, the war in Ukraine. Do you believe that has clearly stopped Moscow hosting any peace talks? After all, they have friendship with both Israel and the Palestinians. Is that why we haven't seen talks open up in Moscow?
Yes, I think it's probably the case that if we hadn't had the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia would have been much more involved at the moment in the diplomacy. It does have relations with Iran, which of course intensified because Iran is now supplying Russia with weapons for its war. And Netanyahu and Putin had a good relationship. They spoke quite regularly and they worked together to sort of keep apart, deconflict their relationship over Syria. But I think that relationship has become a bit more tense because Russia has leaned more to Iran than obviously it has to Israel. But I think that limits the role that Russia can play at the moment. China has made sort of an even-handed statement, but I don't think it particularly wants to get involved in this conflict.
China has definitely damned the slaughter in Gaza in no uncertain terms.
China is not playing a big role in this conflict. You use your language, but it's not going to support the West because it doesn't support the West on very much. But it's just not something that it wants to get involved in at the moment. It's got enough on its plate.
I know that there were those reports, of course, of their warships coming into the Middle East, but apparently that was a routine deployment. But, of course, it was China that brokered the deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, of course, cut off normalisation talks and has been very critical of UK, US, EU.
Actually, if you look at the readout between President Biden and the Crown Prince, it was really quite interesting and quite moderate
That's the White House version in the Times of Israel.
Perhaps you can tell me there's a different Saudi version, but the I don't think Saudi Arabia is delighted with what Hamas did. It was clearly directed against Saudi foreign policy to a degree because they didn't like the normalization talks. The Saudis and the Americans are patching up what had been a pretty poor relationship. And Saudi is still very concerned about Iranian influence in the region. Again, it looked like, as you mentioned, with China playing a marginal, but in the end, not trivial role in helping the two get together, that has led to less than you might imagine. And I think, personally, I think the Saudi role over the next couple of weeks in a constructive sense may be quite important. I'd be looking, as clearly Biden is, at Riyadh as a country that can play a very important part in the diplomacy.
I mean, judging by the horror at the UN Security Council in New York, as people discussed what Israel are doing to...
I'm a horror of what Hamas does, which you keep on failing to mention.
I'm not saying it. I'm judging
these
by
things don't happen in a vacuum. No, we say things don't happen in a vacuum. They also is a response to some quite appalling acts by Hamas. So there's, and most countries have managed to be... to express their concern of both sets of suffering, not just one.
Yeah, no, I'm just talking about the situation. I'm surprised. I mean, as you know, the Palestinians consider that there are thousands of hostages, of Palestinian hostages, kept for decades behind bars in Israel. I think that what I mean is that, of course, while all countries have condemned the taking of hostages by resistance movements like Hamas on October 7th, they also showed horror, as I'm sure we all feel, when we see the picture. I don't know if they're censored in Britain. I know Britain censors a lot of journalism, and the BBC apparently suspended some journalists. But certainly here in this region, the vast majority of people are seeing the horrors of what's coming out. But you're an expert on war, and I'm wondering whether people are looking at what the Russians did in Ukraine, not flattening Kiev, for instance, versus what Israel does to Gaza, what the United States and Britain did to Baghdad.
Have you actually looked at what Russia did to Mariupol?
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the capital.
Thousands and thousands of civilian casualties, systematic attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure, cutting off electricity and water. If Israel has, given them the amount of ordnance Israel had dropped, if they really wanted to kill civilians, I fear an awful lot more would have been killed and have already been killed. They're trying to attack targets, but they're attacking targets in civilian areas. And that leads to what goes on.
I'm just saying, you're an expert on war. It's obviously a besieged territory where half of the 2.3 million are children. If you drop that many bombs on an urban area, is it proportionate?
Proportionate? If Israel had deliberately sought just to kill civilians, and that was the only objective of all of this, then a lot more would have died. The problem is, as you say, that if you're mounting military operations of any sort in a territory in which large numbers of civilians live, and that, as the Secretary General of the UN noted, military installations have been placed amongst those civilians, then that's going to aggravate the problem. Russia attacked, using similar justifications, civilian areas because they said it was part of military necessity to do so.
Russia denied
the whole series.
Russia, of course, denied that. But you think it's proportionate? It is proportional what Israel are doing to Gaza?
Proportionality is. I think, and I've written this, that there are extraordinary limits to what Israel can achieve by military action. And I think they've got themselves in a strategic mess, to be honest.
Is it proportionate?
Let me explain. The anger on 7th of October led them to set in motion a number of things which are not the siege, the tightening the siege, airstrikes, and calling up large numbers of people for a military incursion which hasn't yet happened. Proportionality as a legal concept is extraordinarily difficult. It's not just who's killed the most people. It's about concepts of military necessity or just simple an intention to kill. So, strictly speaking, you wouldn't argue that Israel should have just sent people in to butcher Palestinians in similar ways to the way Hamas butchered Israelis. It doesn't really help. If you want to say far too many
the numbers are just so different.
Of course, far too
Lawrence, many. The numbers are so different. Well, anyway, just finally then, clearly the United States and its EU proxies, they lost in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, let alone, as you write in your book, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, so many other places. Would Iran win a war against the United States with its allies in the region, let alone de facto support from the new BRICS countries, Shanghai Cooperation Organization? Would the United States and European Union countries backing Israel, would they lose?
No, I don't think they would. But the issue of a war with Iran and the issue of whether it's good for Iran partly depends on Iran, and one doesn't get the impression that most Iranians would be desperately keen on the idea either.
No, of course. No one wants the war.
The reason that the United States and its allies fared so badly in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Vietnam before that
and Syria
is because they tried to impose governments in places where they weren't welcome and where the governments didn't have sufficient legitimacy and authority to survive. The reason why Russia has so much trouble in Ukraine is it's not welcome in Ukraine either. Israel was in Gaza. It left out because it left Gaza in 2005 because it wasn't welcome there, and it won't be welcome if it tries to go back in there. It'll have trouble again. That's why you lose wars by trying to impose your will on places which don't want you to be there. You can find examples from many countries where that has been the case. But a straightforward regular warfare between Iran and its allies, such as they are, and I don't think they'd find many people rushing to join in, and the United States and its allies, so long as it was a conventional war, there's no doubt who would win. It would be the West. But I don't see
okay,
any reason.
I think many people will, looking at that, based on the record, doubt that.
I've tried to explain why. The United States has not lost conventional wars. What it has lost is insurgencies. You'll find very few examples where the Americans get beat when it's just regular forces against regular forces. They get beat because they try to defeat local indigenous movements.
Sir Lawrence Friedman, thank you. And that's it for the show. And condolences from the whole team here at Going Underground to those bereaved by the ongoing violence here in the Middle East. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.